Good afternoon. I'm Patty Satalia from Penn State Public Broadcasting, and I am pleased to welcome everyone here at the Nittany Lion Inn to today's Penn State Forum. I'd like to thank Tom Bauer and the Penn State Bookstore for their continued and generous support of this event. I'd also like to extend a warm welcome to Emily Curley. Emily is an English major at Penn State, and she will be writing an article about today's presentation, which will appear in next month's Faculty Staff Club newsletter. Thank you very much, Emily. If you're already a Faculty Staff Club member, you know about the newsletter and about a host of other benefits that come with your membership. If you're not a member, we encourage you to sign up today. To find out more, you can check out the Faculty Staff Club website at psu.edu/department/FSC or talk with a member. They have a table located just outside the ballroom for that purpose. As food for thought on today's presentation, I have a couple of quotes on the subject of truth. Sir Winston Churchill said, "A lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on." And Oscar Wilde said, "The pure and simple truth is rarely pure and never simple." Now we'd like to get started. If you are new to the Penn State Forum, our program is modeled after the National Press Club. Our guest speaker will begin with a 30-minute presentation followed by questions and answers. There are notepads and pens at every table, and we encourage you to write your questions and submit them in writing. Monica Nachman and Catherine McClintock will be circulating throughout the room during the presentation to collect those questions, and as always, I'll ask as many as time permits. Very quick reminder, if you have a cell phone with you, please turn it off. And now to introduce today's guest speaker, here's Dr. Clay Calvert, Interim Dean of Penn State Schreyer Honors College.
Well, thank you for coming today. I think it is fitting that we have an attorney talking with us today. Today is the first Monday in October, which means it is a new term for the United States Supreme Court. We have a new justice, Chief Justice in place in John Roberts. And so it's appropriate that we have an attorney addressing us today, and he is Andrew Vax. His talk today is titled, "Telling the Truth, What It Costs and What It's Worth." Now, a couple of things about Mr. Vax when I was doing a little bit of background research here. He's prolific in terms of the number of books that he's published and the number of op-ed columns that he's published. For instance, in the New York Times, he recently published a piece on June 15 of this year addressing the Michael Jackson trial. And I think the lead sentence to that op-ed actually is very relevant for the topic of today, which is the truth. And the lead sentence to that op-ed that Mr. Vax wrote is this: "A trial is not a search for truth. It is a contest, and often one that produces no winners." So the idea that we sometimes think of the trial as a search for truth, he says a trial is not a search for truth. It's a contest and often one that produces no winners. Now, Mr. Vax is an attorney whose only clients are children. Prior to his legal practice, Mr. Vax worked as a field investigator for the United States Public Health Service in Ohio and as a social casework supervisor in New York City. He's directed programs for urban migrants in Chicago, a maximum security prison for youth in Massachusetts, and a reentry center for ex-convicts in Boston. He's worked as a community organizer, a criminal justice planner, a designer of institutions and programs. He's written numerous nonfiction books on crime and professional journals. His most recent book, it actually was published in June of this year, just came out, called Two Trains Running, was favorably reviewed by the New York Times. It was released again in June by Pantheon. Without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Andrew Vax.
This is a pretty good deal, isn't it? I don't know about this part of Pennsylvania. In New York, if you offer people this much food for $12, especially food you could digest. This is a tough deal for me. What I'd much rather do, obviously, talked about bifurcating the program between a speech, which probably a small percentage of you want to hear, and questions and answers, which are much more my natural habitat. I divide it a little bit differently. So if somebody could volunteer to, I don't know, raise their hands or pour a cup of water on the ground or whatever, when I'm anywhere near the 30-minute limit, I would deeply appreciate it, okay? All right. And the other problem is the typical kind of talk I give isn't really suitable. It's no joke for lunch. All right. I'm here to talk about the truth and the way people discovered the truth. My first job, and I mean, you know, sort of professional job. I did all kinds of work before I actually left school. But when I left school, I got a job as an investigator with the United States Public Health Service. Now, what does that mean? Well, at that time, there was a heroic program going on in America to attempt to actually eradicate sexually transmitted diseases. This is pre-AIDS. Syphilis was the major target. What my job was kind of simple. Somebody would come into the clinic, they'd be diagnosed with syphilis. I had to persuade that person to disclose to me all his or her sexual contacts within a fairly narrow period of time, usually 90 days, but sometimes up to a year. I had to find those people. I had to test all those people, and I mean literally, we carried the needles with us, test all those people, and then if anybody came back positive, start the process again. So what you're looking to do is break chains. Now, I was one of those, maybe some of you will recognize this portrait. I was one of these young people who, because they hadn't been raised in a prep school, thought they were pretty tough and they kind of knew everything. So I fit in really well at the beginning. My colleagues from my graduating class, and I do want to tell you this was hardcore training, not like they have today. Training today, have you ever seen Training for Lawyers? Any of you? Well, it's called continuing legal education. What happens is if you show up and don't leave, you pass. Nobody ever tests your proficiency whatsoever. Well, back then, when they trained you to do interviews of recalcitrant, sometimes hostile subjects, not everybody, again, this is pre-Jerry Springer, not everybody's willing to sit there and discuss their sex life with strangers. They used closed-circuit TV. And you're at the clinic, and I'm at Cook County in Chicago. Next person comes in. You're on tape. If you don't succeed, you don't graduate. That's it. You start over. If you start over and fail the second time, adios. That was it. It's luck of the draw. You may get somebody walking in the door who just left a bar and can't wait to not only tell you everybody he's had sex with in 90 days, but to amplify it so radically and exaggerate it so extensively that you could put a whole crew on the job. Me, I got a woman who was a follower of Elijah Muhammad, who greeted me with, "Good afternoon, Mr. Devil." It took quite a while before we established anything resembling a rapport, but she did finally disclose a contact who turned out to have syphilis. And I went on from there. And by the way, off that experience, it just raised my arrogance level. Because while my classmates got to go to the penthouses and places like that, I got to go to the whorehouses. Because they did this on really on a class basis. Any of you old enough to remember how the FBI used to dress back then? If you are, you remember why they never worked undercover. Well, we had the same nonsensical sort of rules, unless you were a field investigator. Nobody expects you to walk into a house of ill repute dressed in a white shirt with a snap-on tie. Just didn't play. Although I'm sure they saw customers like that, seeing the same one over and over again probably wouldn't have worked. So I'm doing this job, and I'm doing it really well. I love the job. There was no supervision at all because once you started on a chain, you followed it to the end. That was the deal. And boy, I thought I'd seen everything, you know? Because when you interview a man who says, "Look, the only place I could have gotten this was from this prostitute down the river someplace. I don't know her name. I think people called her Mary. I just remember she was a blonde. but she hung out at this particular bar. You'd have to go to that bar and hang out until you ran across Mary, and now you have to get Mary to talk to you. So after a while, you start to feel like, you know, you're really good at this. You can get people to talk. Well, there was a clinic. Lots and lots of clinics because you were a circuit rider. But there was one particular clinic that I worked in. Not far from here, Youngstown, Ohio. One day, a human being came in there, and his genitals were horribly lacerated. And everybody, especially the males there, just felt, I mean, God, what an injury, what a terrible thing. He said he was very drunk. He caught himself in his zipper, a pair of heavy farm overall zippers, and he ripped it up. And some people laughed, and some people felt bad. But one old nurse, and by old, remember, I'm 22, so one old nurse who'd served in the Army grabbed me, pulled me aside, and said, look, he didn't get that from any zipper, which hadn't occurred to me at all. I'm like this hardcore guy who's going out and doing all this. It hadn't occurred to me. In this human being's dwelling, we found what was left of his baby. He'd torn the baby about in half because he'd penetrated the baby without a lubricant and came to the hospital because, as he said over and over again, I hurt myself. In talking to him, what came out of him was this rage at me. He kept saying, that's my child. Where does the government get the authority to come and interfere with what is his property? Now, I thought, and I'm not in any way a religious person, I thought I met Satan. I thought I met the most horrible human being on the face of this earth. I never could have believed, and I'd seen some nasty stuff, I never could have believed that this human being had brothers and sisters, not just in that town, but all over the world. And that truth, which I'd not been told, it's amazing how little incest was ever emphasized in all the training that we did, just fried my nerve endings. And I went out kind of in hot pursuit of the enemy. At every turn, while well-intended, turned out to be not only a wrong turn, but taught me more. So I became a caseworker with New York City's infamous Department of Welfare. Because I'm going to do something about child abuse, right? The government was abusing all these children. I'm sorry if you don't like that. I'm sorry if that offends you. But when you talk to a 10-year-old girl, like the naive fool I still was, and you say, what do you want to be when you grow up, sweetie? What do you want? And she says, I want my own case. You know the wheels have come off. You know that we've consigned generation after generation in the guise of support to perennial impoverishment. And not just impoverishment of cash, but of spirit. The first child abuse case that I was involved in there wasn't. I'll tell you about it. And again, I apologize if you know, you've just had your lunch. Do you know what alopecia is? It's sudden traumatic hair loss. One of my clients had a child who was just hitting puberty. I don't know if she was 12, maybe. She suffered this disease. She lost all her hair. Now, this may not seem like a big thing to you or me, but to a girl that age, it was horrifying. And I want to tell you something. This young lady was the hope of her entire constellation, not just her family, but everybody around her. She wasn't just bright. She was really smart. She was doing everything you could possibly do in school and then some. Even people in the neighborhood, that was an extremely rough neighborhood, took really a lot of pride in her. And now this girl wouldn't go to school. She refused to go to school. Her mother was in complete despair. So I'm trying to get her a wig, a human hair wig. It's not that expensive. You think the welfare department would pay for that? No. It was like when I tried to get a therapeutic abortion for a little girl who'd been raped by her own father. This is before Roe v. Wade. I wouldn't pay for that. It's like when I tried to get a guy with a fourth or fifth grade education who worked two jobs but had a wife and six kids, could never, ever pay the rent, so he's on welfare. When I tried to get him a grant to go to truck driving school, no. See, what they would do is maintain people but not raise people. Everybody tried to help this woman. Everybody failed. One night, in absolute despair, she gave the child some wine until the child became completely inebriated, and then she sewed a doll's wig onto her child. She gets prosecuted. So my first entry into child abuse prosecution wasn't as a prosecutor, it was for the defense. I wasn't a lawyer. That was intolerable. And it was standard. It was standard. It was happening all the time. I almost didn't see a way out of this until I discovered that where there's truth, there's also a commitment. So I learned something. I went to all the regulations and I studied them till I was an absolute authority. Now, you probably didn't know this, but back in those days, they had what was called welfare standards, which means every human being was entitled to certain things. 3 pairs of underwear, 1 pair of shoes. I'm not exaggerating. A list. 1 chair, 1 kitchen table. Now, you could bring a family up to standard. So if a family came here from the South, which was most typical, with nothing, you could bring them up to standard. But in reading, I also discovered that if there was a fire that destroyed everyone's worldly goods, well, you could replace those worldly goods. Arson broke out on my caseload. And people started getting the things they needed to get off welfare. So by the time I had my first suspension hearing, I was able to say, yeah, that's right. There was no fire in that man's apartment. That's true. I don't know how I could have checked the wrong code, but that's what happened. And yes, he did get a check. And, you know, he did, in fact, use that money to go to truck driving school. There's one thing unique about him. You know, he's not on welfare now. But why don't you go ahead with your prosecution? Because I'd love to have this one be public. They didn't. In fact, they just wanted to make sure I didn't teach these devil tricks to other people. So they made me a supervisor. This proved to be error on their part. Now, this was right during a time when this country was split. I mean, really split. People who think that Vietnam split this country are only half right, because civil rights was splitting the country at exactly the same time. It just had started earlier, so it got paid less attention. Like a lot of young men my age, I was deeply, deeply conflicted about Vietnam. And like everybody my age, I didn't know any truth about it. I knew various political positions about it, but I didn't know truth. But there was another war going on at the same time. I'm looking around this audience, and most of you are not old enough that when I say the word Biafra, it's going to register with you. But how about if I say Rwanda? Does that register with more of you? Or the Congo? See, what Biafra was this. After the Brits finished colonizing Nigeria, they left it. 1960. Tribalism broke out. A group of tribesmen, largely Igbo but also Yoruba, broke away to form their own country, which they called Biafra. Nigeria, which was largely the Hausa tribe, decided to stay Nigeria. But this wasn't a peaceful division. This was very much like our civil war. The difference was Nigeria had the best offshore oil anywhere on the planet. So everybody sort of dealt themselves in, but quietly. And genocide took place. Over 1 million human beings died. The principal weapon in that war was starvation. Biafra ended up being landlocked, and there was no way to get in, and there was no way for food to get in. So all the money, because this was on the front page of Life magazine, this wasn't a mystery to people at the time. So all the money that people donated was rotting on the ground in the form of food that couldn't reach them. And so I really had sort of, the answer to my prayers in that they were looking for somebody to find a way into that zone, any way you could, because there was no route, and set up a land route so that food could get in. So the sole qualification to do this was willingness to do it. Didn't require any geopolitical expertise, any special skills. I did that. I entered the zone, and it's a long, story that might entertain some and might disgust others. But when I got there, I saw not only was it impossible to set up a way out, but that there was no way out. There was no way out. Everybody was going to die. And that's pretty much what they did. I mean, when I got out, I was evacuated. I weighed 89 pounds. There was no food. There was just starvation, malaria, and bombs and missiles and bullets. But when I got back and survived this, and just through luck, I mean, just through blind, stupid luck, not any advanced skills or trade craft or anything like that, I came back, I was so infuriated by then at the steady diet of lies about everything that I just went every place I could think of going. I mean, I tried being a community organizer. I tried running a reentry center for ex-convicts. I tried this. I tried that. It was always kind of the same thing. Like this place I worked at in Chicago, where if you were an urban migrant, which was the word they used for hillbilly, if you'd come to Chicago from West Virginia or Kentucky, any place in Appalachia, looking for work in the mills and found that the mills were closing, well, they'd help you. But first, you had to participate in a program that was essentially evangelical. That was the entrance requirement. I didn't last there long. I didn't last any of these places long. I ended up in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was, now maybe some of you a little bit old enough to remember the great wave of deinstitutionalization that hit this country. Essentially, they finally figured out the juvenile prisons were nothing but crime factories. They were the production line that gave us America's most dangerous, deadly human beings. So they decide they're going to close them. They didn't think a lot about this. They just said they're going to close them. I remember one debate I had with the leading advocate of closing all juvenile prisons. And he said, for what it costs to send one child to juvenile prison for a year, we could send him to Harvard. What do you think about that, Mr. Vax? I said, Harvard don't want these kids. This is science fiction. This is the kind of thing that I've been exposed to my whole life. You make a statement that's true but not possible. I ended up running the state's garbage can because they found out they couldn't really return all the kids to the community because the community didn't want kids who were raised in prison. So we ended up running the one place that wasn't deinstitutionalized, and it was a house of horrors when we came in there. Before they gave us a chance to do it, by us, I'm talking about a collection of thugs, because that's the way they saw us. And why did they bring us in there? Because first they tried a therapeutic program. One staff member was sexually assaulted. Numerous people were stabbed. There was a suicide. Escape was as difficult as, walking out that door. That's why we got the chance to run it. That chance taught me two truths. One is that people respond to their community. And this was a community. I don't mean some therapeutic community. It was a community with its own set of values and structures and cultures that had built up over generations. Changing that was the hardest thing we did. And the way we did it was by having three rules. No forced sex, no drugs, no violence. Now, you're sitting there saying, so what? Big deal. Anyone saying that's never visited a juvenile prison. When I left, not one single kid had been raped in that prison. Not one kid hung himself or tried to hang himself. Not one kid got stabbed. That was a major achievement criminologically. But more importantly, what changed was the culture. Now, if you wanted to work for this place, your qualification was you had to be, same qualification I had for going to Biafra, you had to be willing to do it. We didn't care where you came from, what your background was, and well more than half the staff were ex-convicts. Some of them now working in the very institution that had raised them. Here's how the culture changed. And this is what we told staff members. I don't care if you're a 95-pound woman. I don't care if you're a 300-pound bodybuilder. Nobody goes one-on-one here. You see, because I learned this. I learned that if a kid comes out of his cell, we didn't call them rooms, with a little sharpened bed spring, and I tell him to put it down, and he won't, and I take it from him, and I have to hurt him in the process, what has he learned? Well, he's learned not to show me a knife. He hasn't changed in any way at all. And he already knew that there are some people you can't show a knife to without getting hurt. So he's learned nothing. Carnivals have a phrase, "Hey, Rube," which means everybody get over here, we're having trouble. We had a phrase, "It's everybody's business." We learned that if everybody there took down that kid with a knife, using gym mats instead of fists, not only did we not have to hurt him, not only could he preserve his dignity, but the message was this community won't tolerate it. Because you see, when I came there, they had a point system. Are you familiar with that? Well, in a point system, you get points for doing things well, like being polite or reacting positively to anger issues or any other kind of euphemism. We got there, we looked at the points, and the toughest, hardest, most sociopathically lost kids had all the points. They actually had forced weaker kids to try and escape and caught them. And the part that's not funny is they'd also held knives to their throat and told them what would happen if they didn't vote a certain way at group meetings. These kids had been raised literally, and that's it. That's all they understood from the time they were born to the time they got there. So I learned that if you change culture, even small culture, you can change larger culture. But more importantly, I finally learned the truth. You see, you only have two choices about the people that frighten you. You only have two choices about a Ted Bundy or a Charles Manson or your garden variety carjacker or armed robber or pattern rapist. You only have two choices. You could say they're biogenetic misfires. You could say they've got bad DNA. Or you can say the truth that I learned. We make our own monsters. We build our own beasts. And the formula is pretty simple. And no, it's not simply child abuse. Because if every abused child became an abuser, like some liberal idiots will tell you, the species would be gone. There'd be nobody left. Most abused children do not imitate the oppressor. But the ones that learn early on that that works, the ones that learn early on that there's no such thing as empathy, that empathy is baggage that you carry, that ethics are baggage that you carry and that slow you down, those are the monsters that you'll see and that scare you today. Now, how do you get them? Well, I don't care what you believe in. I really don't. You can believe in the law of nature. You can believe in the laws that we pass in our legislature. You can believe, if you choose, in the laws of God. All of those laws say the same thing. Parents are put on this earth to protect their young. And not just human parents. Parents. If they don't, what happens? Their young vanish. Well, when those laws are violated, and then the larger parent, the state, steps in effect says, that's okay. Because that's mostly what the state does. What lesson do you think the children learn from this? Now, most go on a lifelong search for what they were cheated out of. Most abused children find a way to abuse themselves. Anxiety disorders, booze, drugs, self-abuse carried on as if they're surrogate parenting. Some literally become crazy, and I mean card-carrying crazy, paranoid, schizophrenic kind of crazy. It's a very small percentage. But a smaller percentage yet become evil. And by evil, I simply mean they are human beings without empathy. They feel only their own pain. They respond only to their own needs. Most sociopaths are not murderers and they're not rapists. They're simply people that, because they lack morals and ethics, they pursue whatever's going to work for them. So they can be very successful politicians. They can be successful salesmen. They can be successful at a lot of stuff because they learn to fake empathy. But they're our enemies. They'll always be our enemies. And the only way you could actually have the truth, the only way you could actually have crime prevention, if you were serious about it, is with child protection. And unless and until this country makes that a priority, not crime prevention, which any politician will tell you, I'm for that, but child protection, we're not going to evolve because we've kind of stopped. I mean, we're the only species that tortures for fun. We're the only species that hurts and preys on our own young. So I'm not saying I'm against evolution, and I certainly think the people propounding it are proof that there's no such thing as intelligent design, but I'm telling you that we have to go further than we have because we stopped. The very first case, yeah, I'm way over, right? Okay. The very first case of child protection in America, do you know how they had to bring that case? You know what mechanism they had to use legally? They had to use the animal protection laws. Swear to God it's true. If you doubt me, look it up. In the 1800s, in New York City, a little girl was being tortured by her parents, and there was no dispute that this was happening. But there was no law, literally no law to protect this child. There were laws against maltreating animals. So by using the animal protection laws, the very first case of child abuse was prosecuted in America. Now, as you could probably tell, I could go on speaking like this for several hours without drawing another breath. I know my time's up, and I just wanted to leave you with this. There's a truth about everything. And the idea that we've degenerated so much that people watch the news for what they want to hear is true, because there's liberal news, right? There's conservative news, right? There's religious news, right? There's even fair and balanced news, if you buy it. But the bottom line is, it's not a feed of truth. Journalists today are evaluated by the only consumers, either by how they look, or how well they write, or even if they're good orators, but not by their record of delivering the facts to you. If you tolerate it, not only do you deserve what you get, but you're grown and you can take that. But endangered children, and you think children are only endangered by, you know, hurricanes like Katrina or wars like there are in other countries? Those children will grow up to haunt you like they've been doing for generations. And if you actually search for the truth, I believe you'd be standing right where I'm standing today. Thank you very much.
I must confess that I've never seen anything quite like this. The audience was so riveted that the questions were not coming in as they typically do, so I hope that everyone will take a minute now to write questions. But I did
see,
get
there's an example of gross euphemism, right? If there had been hundreds of questions, she would have said, my God, this was such an engaging talk. Look at all the questions we had, right?
But you brought up Katrina, and two people asked. Please comment on the administration's role and responsibility in the aftermath of Katrina.
It's hard to tell what the administration's role was immediately after Katrina. It seemed to be praying for everybody. I didn't see any. If ever the military might of this country was needed immediately, it was then. The military has the specific expertise required to enter that kind of situation, defuse the violence literally like that. They were not going to meet a whole lot of resistance. And they know how to deliver goods and services in embattled conditions. Waiting that long seemed to me just plain bizarre. I mean, I can't even say it's wrong. It goes beyond wrong. I literally did not understand it. And when hurricanes hit places like Florida, the response was different. The fact that the religious right commented endlessly that New Orleans brought it on itself made me want to throw up. Because, you know, I actually don't understand the lack of response. I do not.
Did your Massachusetts experience become a model for other institutions? And if not, why not?
I only wish it had. I believe that I wrote, my first book was actually a textbook about juvenile violence and about the physical design of prisons and how that contributes to the culture of the prison. Lots and lots of people have cited it. Lots and lots of professionals in the field have written and said, well, we've adopted this format, this technique. But in terms of an actual place being built to run on that model, no, we've been trying for years. I mean, we've come close, we thought, a couple of times, where we had a state ready to actually build the facility and follow the plans, but it's not succeeded. Why not? Well, for one thing, the capital construction costs are enormous. My idea of a state as big as Pennsylvania, if you built this institution to serve all the kids who needed it in the state, probably wouldn't house 100 kids. It's literally a worst of the worst kind of deal. This is not the group. They get the most media attention, but all the media attention is focused on why can't they just go to adult prison? So that's been the biggest barrier to getting this place built.
Should journalists have to go to jail to protect their source of information? If not, can we ever be assured of the truth?
I don't know that they should have to go to jail. I think there should be a journalism shield privilege. You know, if you can validly prove. I think if you give your word, you should keep it. There's nothing special about journalism. If you tell a source, if you tell your friend, you know, your secret's safe from me, it should be. It's supposed to be. So should they have to go to jail? I think that the idea that there's a federal law, which interestingly enough serves the current administration, that supersedes a state law that serves the people, why would you be surprised? Why would you be surprised? Let me give you an example. California, in the wisdom of its people, said if you're dying of intractable pain, like bone cancer or leukemia, and a doctor says it's medically correct, you can smoke marijuana. The feds said, if you do that, we're going to lock you up. Why is that? Now remember, this is a federal administration and it's a Republican administration. But more than that, it's a right-wing administration. Now, I want you to think back. Again, this is an age problem. But do you remember, or I'm sure you've read about it, you go to school, right? That there was a time when there was literally violence committed, and I mean violence to the point of death, committed over desegregation in public schools. Now, those senators who filibustered, another thing the current administration doesn't want, who filibustered against the civil rights laws, you know what doctrine they preached? Do you know why they said they were doing it? States' rights. This same political ideology today is saying you can't smoke marijuana in California, states' rights don't count anymore. The point is, these doctrines are very, very flexible. They serve who's ever in power, and they don't have any independent meaning. So I believe that if the same journalists were protecting a different source for a different reason, jail wouldn't have been a federal option.
Is there a country or a society that is doing a good job of protecting children?
I think there's societies that are trying to do a better job of protecting children than we are. I think Scandinavia in general is. I realize it's a terrible hot button issue with people, but I think outlawing corporal punishment is a step forward. I've been in too many cases where children were tortured for the clear entertainment of their parents, and it was prosecuted as excessive corporal punishment. I think people, I know people, I've been all around this country for many years speaking in a lot of places, people are more passionate about their personal rights than the protection of children. So they see corporal punishment not as something that's necessarily good or bad, but something that belongs to them that you better not try and take away. But I don't see any country really that's gone as far as I would to make that connection between today's victim and tomorrow's predator.
Without massive state involvement, how can child protection be achieved?
Well, that's easy. I mean, the same way you didn't have massive state involvement in Mississippi for desegregation, did you? You know damn well you didn't. You had armed resistance to it, and yet it happened. Why? Because the federal government imposed it. Let me give you an example. Okay. In New York State, say a human being has sex with a 10-year-old who lives next door. That's a Class B felony, a very high felony. That person could go to prison for 25 years. Now let's say that same human being did exactly the same acts with his own 10-year-old. The prosecutor, in his or her sole discretion, by the way, instead of charging sexual abuse of a child, could charge incest. Well, you're saying, well, what's the difference? Since incest is worse. Well, not by law. You see, in New York State, incest isn't a Class B felony, or a C felony, or a D felony. Now, incest is a Class E felony, which means even if you're convicted, you're automatically eligible for probation. So if you grow your own victim, you get this great bonus from the criminal justice system. Nice, huh? Well, so what could the federal government do about that state law? They could say, well, New York, you're getting a ton of federal money for child protection. I mean, in fact, if you didn't get this much money, you'd pretty much have to close your doors. Well, you can't have it unless you eliminate this incest loophole. That's what the federal government could do. And there's going to be a bill to do just that introduced in the legislature before this year is out, in the federal government legislature. I suspect it'll get half a dozen supporters and then it'll die a natural death because it doesn't have any lobbying money, doesn't have any special interest money, doesn't have any constituency money, or it'll be tied to other legislation which people find personally distasteful. So I don't suspect it's going to pass. But could that be done? If there was a collective will to do it, sure.
You've written 15 novels and 2 collections of short stories, books that have financed your crusade and allowed you to represent children exclusively. Why, despite your success, do you say you're not a writer?
You mean the commercial success of books? How many of you have read a book that sold pretty well that after you read it said, are you kidding me? That's everybody. That's everybody. How many of you paid money to go to a movie and walked out there swearing vengeance on, you know, commercial success has gotten, writing is not a meritocracy. That's absolute claptrap. There's better writers than you've ever read who've never been published and may never get published. Better actors than you've ever seen who will never get the chance to be in a movie. Better musicians who will never get to cut a CD. So, to me, being a writer, something it's like in here, is a drive, it's a calling. And I've known lots of people like that, and I'm sure you do too. Some of you may be that person. You have to write. You don't give a damn about bestseller lists or whether anyone even reads it, maybe. You hope for that, but you have to do it. It's something inside you. I don't have that. For me, it was a tool. It was another weapon in the same war that I'm fighting. And that's it. So that's why I don't call myself a writer, because that's not how I self-identify.
Your books take a hard line on the way to deal with sexual predators, death. What are your feelings on rehabilitating, punishing, and treating those who sexually abuse children?
First of all, I'm not in any way exclusively concerned with sexual abuse. And in my opinion, the most long-lasting, deepest scarring abuse of all is emotional abuse. So let me get that clear. Secondly, as far as rehabilitation is concerned, It has to be defined. There's essentially three kinds of people who abuse their kids. The largest percentage by far are people who are inadequate. They simply don't know how to raise kids. Or they're overwhelmed and they can't do it. Or they were raised with, every time they open their mouth, think they turned out pretty good, so they follow the pattern and don't understand the reaction to it. That's most people. Most such people benefit enormously from what's loosely called rehabilitative services. The second group, much, much smaller, are people who are insane. And I mean genuinely insane. I had a woman who literally basted her child, put the child in the oven, and tried to cook the child because she believed the child had an evil spirit and the evil spirit could be driven out by fire. You can call her a child abuser. She's crazy. We've not been successful with such people. I don't believe we ever will be. Are we successful with obsessive compulsives? Yes. People with anxiety disorders? Sure. People who literally psychotic? No. No. We can medicate them, but there's a little bit of a problem with medication. I remember one woman I won't even tell you what she did to her kids. It was really horrible. She's paranoid schizophrenic, and she had certain beliefs, and she acted on them. Her doctor, who'd had her hospitalized for many years, said she was fine now, and she was completely stabilized on medication. I asked the doctor, if she went off the medication, was she capable of doing the same things? He said, yes. I said, so you're testifying that she should have her children back. You're testifying that if she went off the medication, she could do the same things or worse to her children. He said, well, yes. And I said, and are you now going to testify that if she did, you would swear she's not guilty by reason of insanity? And he goes, yeah. So it's an experiment. And the kids didn't volunteer for this experiment. Which leads me to the third category, which is smaller yet, but beyond any sort of treatment. It's people who are evil. And I don't mean that in a religious sense. People who hurt other people because it gives them pleasure and or it gives them profit. I've known a lot of people like that. If you spend 10 cents rehabilitating them, you've wasted a dime. You're not going to get it. They'll learn more tricks. They'll learn how to fake empathy better. They'll learn the kind of answers a parole board wants to hear. Their techniques of getting closer to victims will be enhanced, but they will not change because empathy is not something you can give somebody. And see, that's where it all goes back to the beginning. How many of you have ever seen an empathetic baby? Of course not. There's no such thing. A baby is the most selfish thing on this earth. It wants something. It makes its needs known, if it can, any way it can. Tries to take it, screams. That's all healthy and correct. A child is supposed to learn empathy from us through socialization. When instead of socialization, a child gets sodomy from the same people that are there to teach him, and when the state intervenes and in effect says, that's fine, that's okay, now you have the recipe for sociopath. And once you've got one, the idea of rehabilitating them, the only people really laughing at that are the sociopaths themselves. They don't understand why we spend any money to rehabilitate them when they A, know it's impossible, B, have no desire to do it, and C, if the positions were reversed, would exterminate us like vermin.
Are any of your fictional characters based upon real people?
Yeah, all of them. I mean, that's another reason for saying I'm not a writer. I mean, when I started writing, what I used to get from these, book reviewers don't get out much. They really don't. So you'd write about things and they'd go, oh my God, that, how could you make up such horrible, filthy stuff? I wrote about predatory pedophiles, modem trafficking, and kiddie porn. Now, you intergeneration guys are going to say, well, so what? Who hasn't written about that? Yeah, I wrote about it in 1986. What do you say now? So how could that be? There was no internet. There were modems before there was an internet. Sorry. People could send stuff over modems, and they were. Book reviewers, when my book came out, said I had the most fantastically foul imagination you know, in the history of American literature. You see, when they talk about ripped from today's headlines, you understand that means yesterday's headlines, right? You understand that means the past. If you actually report from ground zero, if you say, this is what's happening now, if your audience, if my audience was strictly book reviewers, I never would have sold a book. So the truth is, I wish what I wrote was foundationally fiction. That would be, if I had one wish, that would be it.
Talk, if you would, about your biggest allies in your work.
My biggest allies? I mean, I don't know how to do that. Is it the people who run this massive website we've got, all volunteers from all over the world who make it possible to provide what I modestly think is the best collection of resources on child protection available anywhere on the net? Is it them? I don't know. Is it the people who, let me put it this way. I've been a lawyer a long time. I've been representing kids a long time. I've never had a paid employee. Not one. Every single service I've ever gotten has been provided to me in some way by some people for reasons that I don't interview them about. Maybe it's the first political action committee, actual lobby for child protection in America, which is only a couple of years old. You can look it up on the web in 2 seconds. It's called protect.org. Maybe it's them, because it's that group that just got the incest loophole I told you about closed in California. The bill just passed. We're waiting for, I forget the governor's name there, but he's got... And I know I can't spell it, but he's got to sign it, but I don't even think he's got, I don't think he's got the, I'm trying to think of a nice word, but anyway, I don't think he would veto it. Because what happens is, once that got out of the back rooms politically and before the public, because if you poll the public, if you say, do you think that if a man rapes his own child, he should get less time than if he rapes a neighbor's child? Who's going to vote? Yeah. But there's laws like that in most states in America because the public was never asked. So it's hard to pick out so many allies in so many places, whether it's the person who anonymously calls me with information or whether it's the person who shows up every day to work in the office.
Speaking of anonymous callers, what has your work meant to you in terms of your personal security?
Well, I have very good personal security. I mean, there's people who take exception to what I do and why I do it, and they make their thoughts and wishes known. Gotten a lot of threats over the years. People have done some things over the years. So I have good personal security. But you know what? If I were a professional pool player, I would still have great security because my wife was, used to be, before she got fired for refusing to go along to get along, the head of the Special Victims Bureau in Queens, New York. The first such one, and she used to take home death threats the way other people would take home, you know, notes from work. And I saw some of the death threats in court. So, like I said, if I was a personal trainer or something, I would still have this much security.
How do you prevent yourself from being judgmental of those who do not wish to see the truths you speak of, or do you?
Why do I want to present myself from being judgmental? I am judgmental. I'm happy to be judgmental. I'm proud of it. It's nonsensical that you're not supposed to be judgmental. It's always the judgmental people who accuse you of it.
What role should schools play in support of our children?
Are you kidding me? Schools are the front line. Schools are the absolute front line. Teachers see things that nobody else sees. But, you know, it's very easy to point your finger at teachers. It's very, you know, it's very simple to do this No Child Left Behind crap, which is what it is. Teachers have one of the most difficult jobs you can imagine, and they're paid far less than the people who pick up your garbage. The country's already voted about what we think about our kids, if you think about it. Teaching should be a revered profession, as it is in other places. Now, I'm not saying it's always well paid. The highest paid person in the entire state of Colorado who works for the state is the football coach. Most universities, a football coach, and I'm sure this is the same place too. He's paid more than the most highest ranking Pulitzer Prize winning Nobel Prize candidate professor. So you made that choice. I wouldn't put it back on the teachers. I mean, people go into teaching for one of two reasons. Either they have a calling, they have a commitment, and the money just doesn't matter, or they're really not very admirable people who are sort of water seeking its own level. And the question is, who sticks around the longest? I don't know the answer to that. But while I think teachers have the most vital role, really, to play next to parents themselves, I don't believe we're backing their play as we should be doing.
I do have one final question, but I'd like to join you at the podium to pose it. But before I ask that final question, I hope you will all join me in thanking Andrew Vax for what I think in the past 10 years this has been the most riveting, troubling presentation I've heard. So thank you very much for coming here. My guess is that you didn't think you'd have to come to Happy Valley to be mugged, coming from Manhattan, but we'd like to mug you with our official Penn State Forum mug and also present you with this plaque in our appreciation for your making time and your busy schedule to be with us.
It's beautiful. I hope that you'll mail it to me, because there's no way with these security guards they have now that I'm going to get through with glass that could be broken and used to hold people hostage.
And before you go, I do have this one final question. There's a Slovenian proverb that goes like this: speak the truth, but leave immediately after. Is your taxi waiting?
No, I've stood my ground, and I will intend to do that. If somebody spoke the truth and left immediately afterwards, you'd have to question why they showed up in the first place. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Andrew Vax at the Penn State Forum, recorded October 3, 2005. Cassette copies of the forum are available by calling Media Sales toll-free at 1-800-770-2111. That number again, 800-770-2111. This has been a production of Penn State Public Broadcasting.